Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. So during the course of my doing these podcasts, I've come across a number of young women who were widowed totally unexpectedly by accidents and things like that. And it's become increasingly obvious to me that young women often aren't prepared for the loss of a partner or a husband, and that can lead to so much extra aggro on top of the grief that they're going through. So I've come today to talk to Sophie Hamilton of Parfitt Cresswell in Windsor, a solicitor, about the whys and wherefores of being prepared and why it really is important to do it early.
Hello, Dylan. It's really nice to meet you. Thank you for inviting me to speak on this really important topic. And you're absolutely right. There are plenty of people out there who I think either don't want to think about the inevitable fact that we are all going to pass away at some point, or simply think that making a will needs to be complex or time consuming, when in fact it can be made quite simple. But it is, for the vast majority of people out there, I think, crucial to make a will. So just for the benefit of those that don't know, in the absence of having made a will, then something known as the intestacy rules come into play, which is a government set of prescribed rules as to who inherits and who can deal with the estate. And that is a very strict order of priority in terms of your next of kin, your family bloodlines, effectively. And it is quite rare, particularly in this day and age of blended families, that what you would want to happen on your death would exactly match what would happen if you hadn't made a will. I have myself dealt with probates where it has caused huge heartache, where somebody hasn't made a will, and that leaves their nearest and dearest, who they probably would not have wanted to disinherit, in a very difficult position. The classic case at the moment are unmarried couples. There are plenty of clients I have seen who've been together for donkey's years, but for whatever reason decided they didn't want to get married or enter into a civil partnership, and that's completely fine. But there is the issue with that is there is no concept of a common law spouse. Doesn't matter how long you have been with your partner, if you are not married, there is no automatic right in law to inherit. And I think that's something that there is quite a lot of misconception about. So making a will is absolutely crucial in that case if you are married. Even if you are married, people think, well, everything is just going to go automatically to my spouse. Well, it depends. That's not always the case. I'm dealing with an estate at the moment where the husband passed away, was worth quite a lot of money, and there is now going to be a complex division between the spouse and the children, which is going to lead to quite a lot of inheritance tax payable, which wouldn't have been the case otherwise. It's also important to make a will, even if you think, oh, I haven't got very much by way of assets, there's no point. Well, if you've got minor children, it is crucial for you and your partner or co-parent of those children to make a will, so that in the hopefully very unlikely event that both of you die before the children turn 18, it is put down in writing as to who is to be the parental guardian of those minor children. Again, I have seen it happen where the worst happens, and parents of young children die in horrible circumstances. Car accident is one I've had experience of. Left a three-year-old daughter as an orphan, and there was no will, nothing about guardianship provisions, and it led to an enormously upsetting and expensive court battle between the two sides of the family who wanted to take the child on effectively. So there's all sorts of reasons why making a will is really important, and yet still the majority of people die without having put one in place.
The majority?
Yes, it's about 66% is
really?
On the latest poll, I think. So, and the other thing is, if you have made a will, is it up to date? There are many cases where, of clients who come in for a general chat and about something else perhaps. Often the big one is about lasting powers of attorney, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later. And we have a look at their will just to check it matches what they want. And they say, they've died, or I've lost touch with this person. Oh no, that's not quite right at all anymore. So it's really crucial, even if you've got a will, to get it out every 2 or 3 years, have a look, and certainly sooner if there's a change in your circumstances.
Can we just jump back to what you said at the very beginning, because that astonished me. Are we operating under laws from the olden days? Is that what you're saying? Nobody's bothered to update the laws of inheritance?
In terms of...
In terms of spouses and common law, wives and husbands and all that.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. And there is quite a lot of consultation going on at the moment about cohabiting partners being given some rights in law. But as yet, that's never reached the point of almost being enshrined into law. And as far as I know, that's still completely uncertain as to whether it will ever change. So if you are living together with a partner and you haven't made a will, and you own a property together or something like that, it is absolutely essential that you write a will to make sure that they inherit. Because otherwise, again, classic cases, unmarried couples, perhaps without children at that point, their respective estates would pass to their parents rather than their partner, even if they've been together for a very long time. So it's a case where you're absolutely right, the intestacy rules have not changed or kept pace with societal evolution and demographics and how we live, and the fact that marriage is more and more becoming something that we do either not at all or very much later in the relationship stage.
It's extraordinary, really, isn't it, that once common law marriage was accepted, you'd have thought the rules would have changed to go along with them, but that's something really to be aware of.
Yes,
it?
Absolutely. It's crucial that more people are made aware of this fact. It happens on a very regular basis, I have to say, Dilys, that I sit in a client meeting and I say to them, look, you either need to write a will or get married. And sometimes it's both, because even if you write a will and you leave everything to your partner, that's not going to get around a potential significant tax consequence. The thing that often catches people out, they think that, I'll just write a will benefiting my partner, that'll be fine. But actually, the way that inheritance tax works is it is highly, highly disadvantageous to unmarried couples, because effectively, if you're married, anything passing between spouses is completely exempt from tax. You could have won the Euro Millions and you pass away and your spouse inherits the mansion in Marbella and the Learjet or whatever. There would be no tax to pay at that point. But if you are unmarried, the estate of the person who has died would be subject to inheritance tax. And Euro Millions aside, taking the more common situation, the majority asset is usually the home that they live in together. And it has sometimes, in my experience, led to cases where there's been an inheritance tax bill, but possibly not enough cash to pay it, which is a huge hardship potentially. And then all that happens is eventually once everything's dealt with, the survivor's estate is then increased by a bit. When they die, they're going to be subject to tax again. So it is very, very key that people understand the implications of not being married, not just on the inheritance standpoint, but also on the tax consequences as well. Now, that's not to say, having said all of that, that you only need to make a will if you are unmarried. As I said earlier, the intestacy rules would rarely cover exactly what you would want, even if you are married. And also there's the other factor that in terms of the administration of an estate on an intestacy basis, in our experience as practitioners, it takes far, far longer to obtain a grant of probate if there is no will. So if for that reason alone, I would encourage everyone to make a will. It makes things much simpler for your loved ones to have the certainty of a will, and also in the administration of the estate, for whatever reason, the probate registry issue the grants much, much quicker if there is a will than if there is not. Just to illustrate that, the standard wait time at the moment with the probate registry with a will is around 16 weeks from point of application. Without a will, at the moment, average is about 5-6 months.
Wow.
And the process is very much less clear. We have very little control over what goes on at the probate registry in terms of how quickly we can chase things, etc. So having a will makes things a lot easier all around.
So I'm thinking of an example of a young woman, say in her 30s, whose husband suddenly died in something like a tragic accident. Mm. Where on earth does she turn first? I mean, presumably she's got mortgage payments coming up and bills to meet, and she's not going to get probate sorted out quickly. How do people cope?
No, it's very difficult when deaths are unexpected, and you're faced with not only the emotional devastation of losing your partner suddenly, but as you say, the financial ramifications to deal with that on top of everything can be incredibly hard. So there is some government support. The bereavement support payment is there. It's available to spouses, and also has recently been extended to unmarried partners. It is limited, but it is something. I believe it's 3,500 if you've been married, and then a periodic payment for, I believe it's 18 months after that. In terms of other financial aspects, it really depends on what, how the finances were held between the two of them, really. If assets were held jointly, such as a joint bank account, then they pass automatically to a surviving spouse. Assets held in the sole name of the person who's passed away, it really depends on, first of all, did they leave a will? And if so, and that will nominated their partner or spouse as beneficiary, then it would be a case of contacting that relevant asset holder. But the issue we often see is that banks and financial institutions will apply their own individual risk threshold as to what they are happy to release without a grant of probate. Some institutions, such as the classic one is National Savings and Investments, even if you have premium bonds of a very, you know, a small sum, maybe only £2,000, £3,000, £4,000, £5,000, I've seen them insist on a grant of probate just for that, even when there is a surviving spouse and it's very clear from the will they are the sole beneficiary, etc. But if those funds are really needed and your loved ones are going to need that money, that's where I often say to clients, it's worth thinking about how you structure the money, the finances between you. The really difficult cases I have are the ones where somebody walks in to see me, they're newly bereaved, and they tell me, I've got no idea where anything is. My spouse handled everything. I'm not very good with paperwork. I don't know where anything is. So my plea to anybody who might be listening, who is in control of finances, in the thinking that, I'll take the burden of this because either it's boring or I'm better at it or whatever, you are not doing your spouse or your partner any favours. Please make sure that you have it clearly noted somewhere where everything is, or even better, make sure you check in every 3 months or so, have a little financial sum to run through what there is, because it can make things a lot easier if the survivor knows where to go when the time comes.
Really good advice. Mm. So what age would you ideally say somebody should think about making a will?
There's no set age really at all. You know, it is possible to make a will from a very young age, 18 is the earliest you can make a will.
People 16. Don't think they're going to die.
No,
do
this
they?
Is it. Or even 16 if you're in the armed forces. But typically, it's something that's left a lot later, of course. But generally, the advice is as soon as you have got a property or a sum of money in the bank or a child, and those things can happen, obviously, in different orders, but really, the moment that you think that there's something here to protect and I want to make sure that my loved one, whoever that is, gets it. And essentially, making a will needn't be complex. It needn't be difficult. It's possible to write a homemade will. Now, for various reasons, as a practitioner, I wouldn't always recommend that. Homemade wills can cause problems.
Are these the kind of ones you see online where you're encouraged to sort of fill in a form?
Yes, the sort of write your will for £19.99, etc. Now, the problem for the general public out there is that there is a great difference between a will writing firm who are good and regulated, because they are out there. There are fantastic will writers out there. You don't just have to make your will with a solicitor. But there are also other firms out there who will prey on, to be blunt, people's ignorance, and they hook you in with that cheap will offer, and they will try to upsell you something that you do not need. The classic one at the moment, which I am convinced is going to be the equivalent of the PPI scandal of the legal world, is the mis-selling of complex trusts, often marketed as something called family protection trusts. That if I had a penny for the number of calls I take asking me, oh, should I put my home into trust, or should I gift it to my children to get around inheritance tax or care home fees, then to be blunt, Dillis, I wouldn't need to be working this job. But no, it's putting your property into trust is absolutely not the panacea that some firms out there will have you believe. It will lead most likely to an immediate tax charge. It takes control out of your hands. You know, what if you need those assets for whatever reason? And it simply doesn't work. The council have extensive rules, or the local authority have extensive powers known as the deliberate deprivation of capital rules. If they think that you have deliberately deprived yourself of an asset because of anticipated care home charges, assessment to costs and that sort of thing, they have the power to reverse that transaction, no matter how many years it was done previously. Likewise, for inheritance tax, the taxman became wise to that particular loophole back in the 80s. So the only way to transfer your property to your children and avoid inheritance tax and keep living in that property is if you pay your children a market rent for the rest of your life, which isn't always something that you would want to be burdened with. Those sorts of firms out there that will market that sort of thing as a way to cure all problems should be viewed with suspicion, because it is not that simple.
So what is the best, easiest, quickest, simplest, maybe cheapest way of writing a will?
I would advise making inquiries with solicitors or regulated will writers, ideally a firm that has members of the Society of Trust and Estate Practitioners as employees. And that body, known as STEP, is the sort of industry body who are, you know, the gold standard in terms of individuals who have studied at length this area of law, really know trust law, estate law, the ins and outs of writing a will, and the complexities that can arise. So firm of solicitors, firm of will writers, but provided they are regulated and they, as I say, have good staff there who know what they're doing. It is possible also to get it done more cheaply. There are always frequent free wills or discounted will schemes available. I know that WillAid, for instance, is one that runs in November. I know that the Thames Hospice have, back in May, run their Make a Will Month, which I was delighted to support. So those sorts of things are ways that people can write a will if finances are tight, and make sure that it is done properly and professionally and they've had all the correct advice.
Should we come on now to lasting power of attorney then? You've talked about that as well. Who needs a lasting power of attorney? And again, I'm going to ask the same question. What sort of age should you be thinking about that? Is it only when you get old?
No, not at all. And that, again, that's a very common misconception. I usually like to say to clients that you know, a will is only one half of effective estate planning. You really need a lasting power of attorney as well. Because the point is, you want to make sure that things are left neat and tidy, if you like, and easy for your family in terms of the legal side of things at what is already going to be a hugely distressing time. The lasting power of attorney, for anyone listening who does not know what that is, it's the legal document that sets out who can help you manage your affairs if you are still alive but can't do it yourself. And that can be for any number of reasons. It can be for an accident, it could be an operation that didn't go as planned, it could be a stroke, it could be the slow onslaught of something like dementia, etc. So there's all sorts of reasons why it can be needed, but they aren't as commonly known, well known rather, that as wills. It still happens quite a lot that clients come to me wanting to make a will and they have never heard of a lasting power of attorney. Now, the lasting power of attorney, or LPA as they're known for short, they are crucial if you have assets in your sole name and there may be a need for those assets to be accessed if the worst should happen and you're unable to manage that yourself. So again, classically, it's the case of couples where perhaps all of the bank accounts or most of the bank accounts are in one person's name and not the other. Even though you are married, if you are married, the bank won't talk to you about those assets unless there is a lasting power of attorney appointing your partner. The only alternative in that case to get access to that asset is to apply to the Court of Protection for what's known as a deputyship order. And that's a process which takes quite a long time due to court delays, best part of a year, I am told, and costs quite a lot because the court, rightly so, have got to investigate, is this the right person to appoint? Has this person really lost mental capacity? And so on and so forth. Whereas if that person had just created an LPA setting out who they trust most in the world to manage their affairs should the worst happen, then that would have all been avoided. And I like to tell my clients, you should think of it as the insurance policy you hope your loved ones never need. But if they do, they are immensely valuable and will grant them the immediate standing they might need to assist you.
So couples should do it for each other. But what about children in the family? Should they do it for their parents?
So it depends on, so when I'm advising parents of adult children, I usually say to them, certainly appoint each other, and you can appoint not just the other of you, but you can also appoint your children, provided, of course, that they trust them implicitly, they get on, and crucially, they get on between themselves as well. It can be quite difficult when the attorneys do not get on, but that's why at the outset, when you're creating a lasting power of attorney, it is very critical to carefully consider, who am I appointing? Are they going to act properly? Do I trust them? And crucially, are they going to act well together? And if there's any doubt on that fact, my advice is usually not to appoint the person who you might think, actually, I'm not 100% sure about them. There's been a high profile case just a couple of weeks back in the media. You might have read about it. Dillis, the nephew, was appointed as attorney for his aged aunt, and nothing was untoward until it was realised that there was not sufficient funds in her bank account to pay her care home fees. And the reason being, nephew had pilfered about £600,000 worth of her assets. So that's why it is crucial to think about it carefully. Lasting powers of attorney are one of the most powerful legal documents there is. You are effectively giving somebody else the possible power to do anything you could have done. And so it's crucial that people understand that attorneys, if they are minded to, they could rob you blind. There's nobody going to be keeping an eye unless somebody were to cry wolf, for instance. If you lost capacity, you're not going to be able to. So crucial you appoint people you trust implicitly. Now, that's not to say if you don't have anyone out there that you shouldn't still think about it. We are ourselves, our trust corporation firm, are appointed as professional attorneys when there is either no surviving family members or they aren't perhaps trusted to act in that capacity, or for whatever reason it's not appropriate that they're appointed. Now, obviously that is less than ideal, or if you have loved ones who can act, that is the preference. But if not, it is preferable that somebody is appointed than none. So that is always an option if people don't have anyone that they can appoint in that capacity.
Now, you've been talking about the financial LPA, haven't you?
Yes.
But there's also a health and welfare one.
Correct,
there as
that's
well.
Right.
Do you deal with those two?
Absolutely. And they are very similar in terms of what the actual document looks like, but they are profoundly different in terms of what they cover. So the property and financial one, as it says on the tin, deals with making decisions as to your bank account, your finances, and if it comes to it, things like selling a property and so on. Whereas the health and welfare lasting power of attorney deals with decisions about medical treatment. It's not just that, but also where you live, if a decision has to be made in terms of what care home you go into, that sort of thing. It's often the one that people tend to think, oh, I don't need that one, I just need the finances one. I usually say to that, well, that's fine, but just consider carefully how that might look. And what might happen as a result. And often it's the really emotive decisions that have to be made at a crucial time. And in the worst case scenarios I have seen, in the absence of a health and welfare lasting power of attorney, certain care homes, for instance, tell a spouse of many, many years that they have no standing to make decisions about health and welfare, and to insist that they involve the local authority in some decisions, which is something that I can understand why the care home are saying those sorts of things, but it's very upsetting for the long-standing spouse and family members of that individual to feel completely powerless, and because ultimately they are the ones that know that person best. They know what they would have wanted, and if that health and welfare lasting power of attorney had been created as well, all of that would have been avoided. Now, lasting powers of attorney, you don't, strictly speaking, need to see a solicitor to prepare them. We do them, of course, as a matter of routine for our clients where they request us to, but I would like to encourage anyone listening to look into it, and it is possible to do it yourself. You do not need to involve a solicitor unless you want the guidance and the assistance that would come with that, which has its value, and that's why we charge the fees that we do. But there is a lot of guidance online, so the gov.uk website has a portal through which you can make a new lasting power of attorney. It still needs to be printed out and signed by everybody, etc., and there's quite stringent rules about how you complete the form and the order that people sign in and so on and so forth. But the guidance provided is quite extensive, and provided you read it carefully, it's perfectly possible to create a valid lasting power of attorney yourself. And I would argue in many cases better to do it that way than maybe leave it to chance and not have anything done at all. It doesn't just have to be online. You can request the paper forms from the Office of the Public Guardian. I think they have a free phone number you can ring up, and they can post the forms, you can fill them in, that sort of thing. But I think it's crucial that more and more people understand why these documents are really, really important, particularly as we are an aging population, as we are living longer and longer. There may well come a time for most of us that these documents are needed. Now, they're not only needed if you lose capacity. It could be that you simply want some help. The lasting power of attorney for financial and property matters can be used as what's known as a flexible, simple power of attorney. So if you simply reach the grand old age of 99 and simply cannot be bothered, but still are sharp as a tack mentally, you can use the LPA to allow your children to take over, if you like, with your finances, with your approval, of course, it has to be with your consent, but they can manage, help you manage your affairs in that way, even if there hasn't been any impairment in your mental faculties.
Really interesting. Well, I think we've covered all the main things that people have to do, but as I've got you here, I'm dying to ask you a bit more about the family dynamics, because all these things are to do with avoiding conflict, aren't they, really?
Yes.
And yet you must see quite a bit.
Yes, that is an understatement, Dilys. Unfortunately, it's, as I'm sure most people can imagine, very common that family dynamics, which may have seemed simple or cordial or warm, even change completely on a bereavement. It can be over very minor things. And I think you've got to think about making a will and a lasting power of attorney as the loving thing to do for your family. It is not morbid. It should be viewed as an essential step to make your wishes known and clear, because where it is unclear, it can lead to huge division and upset after death. It's also important if you are thinking about doing something slightly difficult in your will, classic one being cutting out a child, for instance, from whom you might be estranged. There are certain steps that can be taken to make that will more robust to challenge. If you do a homemade will on that basis, it is there are certain steps that could lead that to be overturned in some cases. So for those sorts of difficult wills, it is worth seeking the professional advice, and they can give you the information as to how that will could be challenged after your death and how to potentially protect against that happening. A crucial one being, of course, is that the very will file of the solicitor drafting it or the will writer drafting it would be evidence in and of itself. So if you are thinking of doing something slight that may be contested after your death, that's when I think any homemade wills should be steered well clear of, and professional advice should be sought. But yes, the family dynamics can be hugely difficult. I routinely deal with probates where the children of the deceased are the executors and they don't get on. And appointing executors who can't act cooperatively is very, very difficult, and to be honest, raises the costs quite substantially. So it's important that people think carefully about who's going to be in charge of things after they pass away and how that works in practice. But no, there's no easy fix, unfortunately, because we're all complex human beings and we are unfair human beings. Wills are often unfair, and I think that that's also something we're seeing a lot of. There is a big rise at the moment in people contesting wills. There are firms out there that will take on cases on a no win, no fee sort of basis. And with, as I say, the rise in blended families, etc., opportunities for a valid challenge are increasing. So it's worth, as I say, always taking professional advice, making sure that you know you have got a will which is as robust as it can be. And that your family also know that you've made one and where it is. It does happen that wills get lost because people don't know you've made one, or that it might be with your solicitor that you met with in Exeter when you lived there 5 years ago, but you've now moved to Barnstaple or wherever it might be. So that's the difficulty as well.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because in the classic films and documentaries and television programs, you see people hunting through desk drawers, don't you, for the actual will? But I hadn't really thought of that. It could be that it's not even within the home at all.
No, indeed. And it commonly isn't. Sometimes people, when I write a will with a client, they choose to take it away with them and store it at home. But most of the time, they are happy for us to store it on their behalf. We're insured for that. We've got fireproof safe and all of that, and climate control storage, etc. But it's essential that that people, inform their chosen executors where that will is. So, if you are going to put your affairs in order, do make sure you tell people that you've done it and who to contact if the worst should happen.
Lovely advice. Thank you ever so much, Sophie, for talking to me.
You're very welcome, Dilys. Thank you for inviting me to speak with you.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.